I'm Peter Marks, theater critic of The Washington Post.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Village Voice.
And I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the 10th episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group. Our guest today is Erin McKeown, the singer-songwriter who's written the score for Miss You Like Hell, a new musical opening this month at the Public Theater. This is Erin's first musical, and we'll be talking to her a bit later on about the experience of writing songs for an off-Broadway show, now that Hamilton has transformed our expectations about what musical comedies, if you can still get away with using that old-fashioned phrase, ought to sound like in the 21st century.
But right now, and for our 10th episode, and guys, it's 10 episodes we're into
now. We made it.
That's pretty amazing. We've done this.
And we're going to do it until we get it right.
Exactly. We've decided to spend a whole segment of Three on the Isle discussing two newly opened Broadway shows. One of them being Angels in America, the huge new revival that opened last week on Broadway.
And the other one is kind of a revival, but also a premiere. It's the Broadway premiere of Edward Albee's Three Tall Women, which premiered off-Broadway in 1993. Actually, the year Angels debuted on Broadway.
Is that right?
Yep,
oh, that's very interesting. That's interesting. This revival is directed by Joe Mantello, and it's got a terrific cast, a high-powered cast, including Glenda Jackson returning to Broadway for the first time in 30 years, Laurie Metcalf fresh off her Oscar nomination, and her Tony for Dolls House Part Two, and an Oscar nomination for Lady Bird, and thirdly and not leastly, Alison Pill, who you may know from her performances in Blackbird or The Lieutenant of Inishmore on Broadway, and is also in the HBO series The Newsroom, and apparently now is on the new season of American Horror Story.
So
that is
very
that
happy
is
to
quite
have her
a
back.
Lineup.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a lineup and quite a show. So let's start with Three Tall Women. Peter, what did you make of this revival?
Well, two words, Glenda Jackson. I mean, this is a mega, mega, mega hurricane force production. Who can imagine a woman in her ninth decade? Isn't your 80s your ninth decade? Is that how it works?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like 81, I think, or 82.
Counting?
I mean, in a play in which she's on stage through the entire hour and 45 minutes and gives a performance that, you know, it's like, you know, it's one of those cliches, give her the Tony right now. She plays a dowager in this story. She's 81, apparently. We're being told by Kirby Pate. Thank you, Kirby. And it's just the kind of performance that you tell other people they have to see. That's where I start.
Yeah, I completely agree. I completely agree. And, you know, it's one of those things. So sometimes when you wait to see someone so eagerly, there's always this feeling of like, well,
letdown.
You convince yourself that you have to like it.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, or it's like, I paid $300 for Hamilton. I'm going to like it, damn it.
And I'm going to stand at the end because I'm that happy.
I'm going to like it. No. It's really not. It's really, I think Titanic is just, that's actually a bad word.
That one sank.
It was a nice bird.
Yeah.
But it's a majestic performance. Mm. And also very funny and biting and very, very much there and in the moment. Mm. It's wonderful. Mm. But my only thing, and also, you know, The tide, what is it, like rises all boats over?
Right.
Because Laurie Metcalf and Alison Pill, I've always been very good on stage, both of them, really rise to the challenge. My only thing is, like, I did not quite buy them as being the same person. Like, I just can't picture Laurie Metcalf turning into, you know, this is part of the play's conceit in the second half.
Right.
That we're watching the three ages of the same woman.
Right.
And I did not quite believe that Laurie Metcalf would turn into Glenda Jackson. That is, I could not make that jump in my head. The same way, actually, that I could not quite believe that Alison Pill would turn into Laurie Metcalf. There seems to be, it's not a physical thing. It's not the the way they look or anything like that. It's like the
affect.
Character traits and the affects. I just quite didn't. So in a way, it's
fair.
Three women who are very separate.
Terry, what do you think?
Well, I mean, that may be an intrinsic problem of the play, and it certainly is an aspect of the fact that Joe Mantello decided to run this production without an intermission. The play does contain an act break. I thought that it gained in concentration by being done without an intermission.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're having trouble buying them making the switch, maybe that's part of it. What you said really interested me, Elizabeth. What I feel when you're all worked up for something and you're hoping that it's going to be as good as you expect and you realize that it's going to be, I feel a sense of relief that I'm going to get what I was hoping to get. And I felt that with Glenda Jackson within seconds of her starting to
Right,
talk.
Right.
Well, you
it
know
had, right
away.
Out of the Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I knew that we were in good hands. But for me, the thing that I would like to talk about briefly is the play itself.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It, Albee had a very bad patch. He couldn't get a good review, really, between 1975 and 93, I think, was when the premiere of this play mm-hmm. was. I can't remember the exact year, but... that was a long, long time between drinks. And suddenly he comes back and he sweeps the table. And everybody mm-hmm. realizes, well, yes, he is uneven. But at his best, he's like this. And I think seeing Three Tall Women again at a distance, and it gets done a lot regionally, but as we mentioned, this is its Broadway premiere. I think it's just possible that it's his best play. I would want to sit on that for a while and think about it.
Did you guys see it off Broadway?
I did not.
93, 94?
You know, I didn't love it quite that much. I was impressed by this production. I thought it had all the pieces working correctly. And, you know, with some caveats, the ones that Elizabeth mentioned I think are fair. But, you know, I kind of like Albee when he's more enigmatic.
Mm.
I felt this play... was, you know, almost spelled it out too clearly for me so that I, you know, sometimes I like playwrights who aren't, don't feel as if they have to cater to an audience's demand that you explain it all. And this one felt a little bit facile at times for me. The way that The Goat, or Who is Sylvia, another later play that he did, also felt... I almost like he wasn't being true to himself in a way. I mean, I know that Virginia Woolf is a very, and I do think that Delicate Balance is his best play, I think, maybe all told. But, and I like those enigmatic qualities that he could absolutely, it was like that, fuck you, I'm telling the story I want to tell it, not the way you want me to tell it. So that's my only hesitation with saying where I would put this in the pantheon of Albee plays.
I think you can make a case for saying that, I do, but I was swept away by it because, for one thing, I like Albee better when he's neater. The Zoo Story very much accepted, but
mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, this is a very neat play, but mm-hmm. it is a neatly made play.
It's well made.
Yes, but it's a well-made play in which the characters, especially after the non-existent intermission in this production, have extraordinarily penetrating things to say about the process of age. I mean, you...
Mm-hmm.
With
Albee, it's like he's stepping out in front of the proscenium and telling us something deeply and profoundly felt. And I was swept away by it. I remember when I left the theater that night, I was actually having trouble. I saw a number of people that I met as I was coming out of the house, and I was actually having trouble talking to them because I was so completely in the world of the play's last 10 or 15
That's
minutes.
That's wonderful. The last 10 or 15 minutes are sublime.
I would agree with that. I think actually the play strikes a really pretty perfect balance of the cryptic and the naked and the revelatory about what we know about who the woman was inspired by.
Mm.
It's said to be inspired by his own mother.
Totally.
So, of course, I'm sorry, I've had this cold for like weeks now and I can't get rid of it.
I know. Yeah,
I don't realize it's giving me like really a sexy husky tone, but it's not necessarily wanted.
We like that, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say that I am not like a really big Albee fan overall, But that one may be my favorite. I would agree, because of that balance between the two strains of his writing. And they work really well in this production. The last 10-15 minutes are absolutely transporting.
Yeah.
Transporting.
And we have to also say, I think, you know, that the one of the heroes here is Scott Rudin, and I say that because of what he's bringing to Broadway. And to bring this play, I think, is a challenging thing to get audiences to come to see, even with those names. And I think that that's, you know, that's this sort of other Broadway that still exists. And this is one where you had stars, but not stars for the sake of stars. These were people cast consummately for the roles they were playing, even with some physical limitations. I understand that Marion Seldes played the middle B,
yeah,
in the original.
Part that Laurie Metcalf is playing,
and you could
now
see where that the problem, as Elizabeth's discussing, is there's a patrician quality to A,
mm-hmm.
and the characters are named A, B, and C, and that evolution is not really clear in the construction of these characters. How we get from C to A, so to speak, is not. But maybe that is the enigmatic quality for the play. Maybe that is, for me, that quality of, you know, mystery. You know, who we become is not so apparent when we're 27 years old,
yeah,
and end up being 92.
And again, that was not enough to prevent me from thoroughly enjoying the show.
Right, right. No, exactly.
It's one of these things where, okay, I'm not entirely buying it, but I'm still completely involved and engrossed in it. Mm. I'm not buying it, and yet I am buying it. I was with the show the entire time.
Right, right.
And it's a really dire season for plays on Broadway, and God, thank God for that one. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of major and challenging plays that are back in New York after a long absence.
Very nice segue.
Angels in America, which mm-hmm. is returning to Broadway. It has, in the interim, has had an important off-Broadway production. And it continues to be done all over the United States and all over the world. But this is an extravaganza. It is the transfer of the National Theater's production. It stars Nathan Lane, which by definition, and Andrew Garfield, which by definition makes it a box office item. What did you guys think of this revival?
I loved it. I had never seen Angels on stage. I had only seen the off-Broadway revival at Signature a few years ago, which I didn't like. And I remember thinking at the time, that's it? That's that play? Mm. Well, God, talk about overrated.
Mm.
And it's amazing the difference a production can do.
Wow.
And I had seen the movie, which the HBO...
Oh, the HBO, the Mike Nichols directed thing, yeah.
So when I saw this current production, I thought, okay, I get it. That's it. No, you guys are right. That's it. You know, it's like, oh, and there was the book and all this insistent talk about the book. And I'm like, stop with Angels in America. And now I'm thinking, no, okay, fine. No, it is what it is, all that. My caveat with the show, I do have one. I really, really loved everything, but I did not buy Nathan Lane as Roy Cohn. I did not buy the completely intrinsic awfulness of Roy Cohn, because I kept thinking this is a character playing at pretend evil. I could not get into it. And it's nothing to do with Nathan Lane himself. I mean, he was perfectly fine. He can do dramatic work. I can buy him in that. He was fine in Iceman Cometh. I mean, it's not that. But in this particular case, I was just not. The friend I saw the show with was actually. Since we're in a minority to think that Nathan has been getting grave reviews for that.
Yeah, and so, I don't think evil is the right word for Roy Cohn. I think he is, and one of the great things about this play is that these characters are all deeply human, and there's more.
There are bad humans.
That's true. No, he's not a good person. That's for sure. But you know, he wouldn't be interesting to watch in any circumstances if he's just the manifestation of satanic.
He's not just that, but he has to be that.
No, I don't think he does. I think to be able to laugh, he's a comic character in many ways. He's a buffoonish mm-hmm. character as much as he is malevolent. And I would say, I mean, that's just a way to preface.
Malevolent is a much better word than evil. You're absolutely right. Yes.
I would say that it's the best production of Angels ever done for me. I thought Marianne Elliott, you know, I was nervous because I thought she was a visualist. I thought that I'm an imagist. I thought she was really just sort of a person who put amazing pictures on a stage. But it turned out her sensibility for me was that she's the director, was exactly right for this production. She brought things I thought visually. I was skeptical when I first saw Ian McNeil's set, but as it metamorphosed and used more aspects of the movement of the stage, it became this, you know, this spectacle for me that really, really worked. The only aspect, and I thought that Denise Goff and James McCardle, who play Harper and Lewis, were fabulous. And I think Andrew Garfield is giving a performance that, as Prior Walter, that reveals levels of his skill that I had no idea he had.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I think I wouldn't say it's on a par with Glenda Jackson, but it's getting there. So those things just made it a thrilling experience for me. And the other thing was, and the thing I hear from people that I know who are reluctant to go, resistant because they hear 7 hours and they don't know if they can do it again, is that this moved for me more fluidly than things I see that are under 2 hours.
Oh my God, so true. And you know, it reminded us also, entertaining. The play is incredibly funny.
Exactly.
I had not laughed really, at least not that much at the. And it's not a bad thing to say, oh, I laughed at Angels in America.
Right.
You're not
belittling
the show. The show is. It really is all that, and you can laugh during the show, and it doesn't prevent other emotions.
I think Terry had some.
This
some
being three on the aisle and we being we, let me disagree with both of you on a couple of salient points. First of all, I think Angels works better when it's done small. I think it's a conceptually big play that actually, it only requires 8 actors. And I think it gains in concentration when it's done on a small scale. I've seen it done that way twice now, off-Broadway and then at the Court Theater in Chicago. And I think it's a better play. This production seemed to me to be what you thought it was not, Peter. It was too much like the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime to me. It was too showy, too neon, too much stuff. And as for Nathan Lane as Cone, I know that's not Cone. I mean, for us, Cone is a living memory. But he's not a living memory now for most of the people who see the play. And I was very struck by his willingness to take us away from our idea of Cone, which is logical because Lane is he's a serious actor whose affect is comic. The thing that struck me the most about Lane's performance is the big monologue when the doctor tells him that he has AIDS, which is one of the most frequently quoted parts of the show, you know, where, you know, he says, you know, I'm not a homosexual, even though I have sex with men, because I have clout.
It's a great monologue. It's a fantastic monologue.
It happens. Al Pacino, of course, his version of that monologue from the TV version is available to view. And it happens that if you go on YouTube, you can find all of the B-roll for the original Broadway production of Angels in America, which means that you can see Ron Liebman do the first part of this monologue. Liebman does it like a hand grenade that somebody's pulled the pin on. Pacino does it with tight, cold-eyed control. And what amazed me about what Nathan Lane brought to that monologue, he did it with fear. You could hear the undertone of fear, something that you do not normally encounter from Cone at this stage in the play. I don't know if that's the right way to do it, but it made such a deep impression on me.
Oh, that's interesting.
It just reminded me, this guy, too often we think of him as the comedian, the musical comedy guy. He is an immensely serious actor, and he does interesting
things.
There's
absolutely no debate about that.
And it was the first time I've ever believed that Roy Cohn was in love with Joe Pitt.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. No, it's true. Yeah.
I have a question for both of you. I have a question. You know, The prevailing thought is that, you know, Perestroika, the second play, is inferior to Millennium Approaches, which is, you know, generally celebrated as the more accomplished, well-made work. Did you feel that watching it this time? Because for me, they were very much in balance, the two plays. They suddenly seemed to be speaking to each other, even, in ways that I had never sort of recognized before. Am I out of my mind?
Well, I mean, to me, the problem with Perestroika is the bad parts, not the good parts. I mean, the good parts hook up. Bad and good is not the right word to use, but the parts that work hook up directly to Millennium Approaches. I have never much cared for the hallucination scenes. It just seems to me that there is too much of them, and that they throw the whole thing out of balance. But I can't watch Angels without wishing that I could cut 3 hours out of it. I just think, of course, if you did that, then it wouldn't be Angels.
Correct.
Kushner wouldn't be Kushner. Right.
But to go back to your point about how you think Angels works better if it's done small, I think in a previous podcast we had talked about how a lot of the themes in Angels are very resonant now, and it's not specifically the AIDS part, but it's that feeling of dread and that sense of impending doom that is very much in the play. And when we were talking about that earlier, I had not seen the show, but now I have. And I think actually this is even more present in the production, and which is why it's important to me that the production is big, because it really works. It kind of emphasizes that aspect of the play, the sense of global doom, which is not linked to AIDS, but to an epidemic of just stupidity and greed and just the technology run amok and ecological destruction. And it's all in the play. It's crazy that it's all in there. And to me, it really works that it's done on a big scale.
Right. It's interesting that we talked about the whole small cast syndrome in a previous episode of Three on the Isle, and that here, you know, you and I are arguing for bigness with a cast that isn't that big. You know, it's eight characters essentially playing, you know, eight actors playing, you know, 30 people or so. And I thought you want to see it sort of as operatic. And that's what it feels like to me, that there are so many of those emotions. I can also make a case. I think we're all right. I think Terry's right, too.
Right.
I think you can see it done in a very intimate way, which I've seen also and had a whole other experience of it. But on Broadway, anyway, if you're going to do it big.
I'm sure we could go on talking about Angels or Three Tall Women, for that matter, for at least another hour or two. But it's time, and a pleasure as well, to introduce today's guest. Erin McKeown is one of America's most talented and individual singer-songwriters. Her music is famously hard to pigeonhole. Not only does it occupy a wholly individual space, somewhere in between rock, folk, and pop, but the subject matter of her songs is just as varied. Some are intensely personal narratives, while others have a hard political edge. On top of all that, she also has a passion for the Great American Songbook, and one of her albums, Sin You Sinners, is a collection of cover versions of standards, like Johnny Mercer's Something's Gotta Give, and Cole Porter's Just One of Those Things.
Cool.
I'd say all that makes Erin unusually well-equipped to write a musical, and for Miss You Like Hell, which opens at the Public Theater on April 10th, she's collaborating with two very well-known names. The book of Miss You Like Hell is by Chiara Alegria-Hudis, who won a Pulitzer Prize for Water by the Spoonful and wrote the book for In the Heights. And the production is directed by Lyra de Bessonet, one of the rising stars of American theater. Erin, thanks very much for taking time out from rehearsing Miss You Like Hell to join us today. You know that I'm a longtime fan of your music, and I was hugely excited to learn that you were working on a show. How did that happen, and what's the show about?
I remember that conversation, actually, when I told you about it. And that was a very kind intro. Thank you, and thank you for being such a supporter of my music for a long time. Well, it happened in, you know, I'm someone who grew up loving musicals. And for me, theater was I don't know, just like, I grew up in a really small town in Virginia, and so we had like the High School Musical, and we had like the summertime, you know, auxiliary, women's auxiliary, like gala, and right. that was pretty much it. And I grew up about an hour south of Washington, D.C., so.
What town?
Fredericksburg.
Ah.
Yeah, and, you know, when I was growing up, Fredericksburg was less a part of D.C. than it is now. We got a commuter train after I left and went to college, but I did not grow up with any sort of theater industrial complex. I grew up with theater as community.
Right,
I mean,
right.
you know, I grew up with theater as community and as something my friends did. And every once in a while, my dad would get on stage and put a funny hat on and sing something. And, you know, the biggest thing was like, who was going to star in the High School Musical? And so, you know, one elementary school, one middle school, one high school, you watched everyone come up. You like fell in love with like whoever the stars were that year. You wanted to be like
right.
them. Then you got into high school and you hope they said hello to you. Like when you walked by the hall, like that's what theater was for me. And then I ended up becoming a professional musician, which is I never thought I would do, which is another podcast. But, you know, and I during time off, anytime I was traveling like all over the world, I have a day off, I go see a show, whether that was in London or Glasgow or Chicago, and just for fun because it had nothing to do with what my job was. And so I ended up, you know, seeing a lot of different things, loving musicals, mostly traditional musicals, I would say, and never just that theater was fun. Theater was the thing that wasn't my job. And I got an email from Kiara. There's like a catch-all email on my website, you know, mostly for spam. But I got an email from her in May of 2011 that said, you know, like I'm a writer. Here's what I've done. I have this play that I think should be a musical. I think you're the person for it. Are
wow.
you interested?
So it's
amazing.
Not like you had friends in common or
no.
anything. She emailed you through your website.
No, we didn't have anything in common. I mean, we both went to Brown, but at different times. And she's from Philly, and you know, there's that's probably a city where I've had one of the longest, deepest connections with the music community and the radio station. And so I think one of her friends from Philly that knew about me from college or something, but really we had no connection at all. And she just writes this email that's like, you know, I wrote in The Heights and I have these other plays.
This doesn't happen in real life.
No, it doesn't happen in real life. And the thing that I love about, and this was before the Pulitzer. And so like
right.
the thing that I love about this email is that she just wrote it from both a humble, like if you know Kiara, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to talk to her and know her, but if you know her, like she's extremely humble and she wears her success like in a very loose and lovely way, but she's also not ashamed of it. And I find that, especially for women, like to be a rare thing. And that email was exactly that. And she just said, you know, I'd love to get together and do you want to meet? And I had a show at Joe's Pub maybe 10 days after that. And so I invited her to that show, and we had breakfast the next day, and she just told me about what she did. And in those intervening 10 days, I looked, can I cuss on this podcast?
Yes.
Why not?
There's no
privacy
regulations.
I looked at who she was. I mean, I'm ashamed to say I didn't know.
Right.
I knew what In the Heights was, but I'd never seen it. It hadn't
right.
fallen on to one of my hobby theater visits, you know? And so I looked up who she was, and I was like, holy shit, okay.
you know? And, this is a real person.
Yeah, and she wrote that email like as if I got 10 other emails like that and I needed to
right.
choose.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So she was making a pitch to me, not knowing that I've never gotten an email like that in my life. And so we had breakfast that next day, and you know, I've done very little collaborating in my career, and of course, like you all know this, like theater is like only collaborative. So I spent 20 years writing my own songs and driving around alone in my van, basically. And so picking a collaborator is not something I had any experience
right.
with, which is again like I don't know the pie chart, but who you decide to work with when you make theater is
everything.
Yes. And I had no idea, so I had breakfast with her. She gave me the play, we talked about music, and she told me a little bit about the play. It's based on her play 26 Miles, which came out I think in 2008 or 2009, just a straight play about a mother and a daughter that take a road trip. And she said, I always thought it should be a musical, and that's basically it. And I just took home the play, and I thought she was really nice and clearly smart. And
How did you feel about the idea of starting with someone else from someone else's starting point?
I didn't know the difference. To tell you the truth, now, as I'm being like pitched more projects and thinking about what I want to do next, I do have feelings about that. But at the time, I didn't.
So did she have ideas for the beats, what the songs would be? Is that something you guys two worked on together?
Yeah, so what I did was read the... The musical now differs in many significant ways from the play, which I can enumerate for you. But those none of those were there. Those are all... The ways that it differs are all these things that came through our next 7 years of collaboration. What I did was I took home the play and I read it and I circled the things that felt like songs. And there's, you know, her writing is, it is musical anyway, and it is lyrical, and especially certain moments in that show are extremely poetic.
What's the basic plot for people who don't know?
Yeah, so the plot in 26 Miles is a mother and a daughter who are estranged but not living too far from each other. Mm-hmm. There's been a custody situation, and the daughter lives with her father and the mom, and there's and the daughter has a zine, and and they go on a trip that involves the father and the mother's new partner, and to be honest, I don't even remember like more of it. But that's the basic idea. So I just circled things, and you know, there's a song in the show that didn't give you anything away to tell you this, but in both the play and the musical, there's bless you.
Thank you.
And there's a tamale seller that appears, and that to me was one of the first things that it was a long monologue in the play about how he makes the tamales and where the recipe came from, and how he feels when he makes it, and how they feel when they eat it, and it's. That was one of the first things I circled.
Sorry.
But, you know, like Terry was saying in his kind intro, like there's a lot of different things that can turn into songs,
right.
You know? So in some ways, like a long monologue is actually the easiest thing for me to turn into a song. Not that song was the easiest to write once we got into it, but the idea of it. But, you know, this is a road trip musical in many ways, and that feeling of travel that is so easy to do in movies is so hard to do on stage.
It's also interesting, too, because what you were saying earlier, I mean, the road trip is very much, in this country, it's very much like a male rite of passage. I mean, since On the Road, it's just has this mythology of the two... or one or two or whatever band hitting the roads. You know, yeah. I used to love reading like band road tour diaries. It's like a little subgenre of its own. And I love the idea that you have like a woman women doing it.
We don't have very many models of that, right? Mm. I mean, like Thelma and Louise, and look what happened to them. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like they don't get to survive that road trip.
Did you hear the music yourself immediately, or did it take a while for you to hear?
No, Kiara's undergrad training is in music, and she grew up as a composer and a piano player.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that is
that could be a good and a bad thing for you because she would have ideas.
Well, I love her ideas, and it's actually been the greatest thing, and I'll tell you why in a second. But I would say for the first, we met in 2011, and we wrote the first draft of it in late 2012, early 2013, and in between, Kiara had a son, and. But during that time before we were actually working with a draft, we just sent songs back and forth to each other. So we had a running playlist on Spotify. We had playlists on each of our computers. And I would say when we got together for the first writing sessions, it was literally just us sitting on her couch being like, oh my God, do you know this song? And then we'd listen to the song. And then she'd be like, oh, that makes me think of this song. And so the idea of what the music would sound like, you know, came from this collective conversation. Though I will say that I have a record called Hundreds of Lions that came out in 2009. And there was a point where she took that record and wrote a version of the musical on top of it.
Hmm.
Of, you know, a paragraph for each song in the order that it came on that record.
Interesting.
As a way of, it helped me understand the ways that what I was already doing could work, and it helped her understand the way that her writing could interact with my music. So we kind of wrote like a dummy version of it, and then traded songs, and then started to swap out these placeholder thoughts for actual songs.
I'd like to ask you a little more about that, Aaron, if I might. Singer-songwriters in particular, and I'm not talking about you, tend to write songs that are descriptions of internal states, you know, what one is feeling at this moment, or there's songs that tell a story. And theatrical songs work in a different way. I think you may be unusual among singer-songwriters in really knowing what theatrical songs sound like. How did you approach the problem of writing songs that would work in a theatrical setting, would drive action? I mean, what were you thinking? And how did you have to put on a different hat to do this?
No, not really, actually. I actually think the answer, the thing that's in common with both kinds of writing and the answer to your question is form. Like, I think that's the answer to the question for me. That the form of the song, if the form of the song is the storytelling, then what goes inside that form, it doesn't matter if it's internal or external. Just to give an example, there's a song in the show that is called Lioness, and it's sort of tells us what you need to know about Daphne Rubin Vega's character, Beatrice, who's the mom. And the form of the song is kind of when we were writing it, we were looking at Eminem, 8 Mile. We were looking at the opening of Jesus Christ Superstar. We watched an Al Pacino monologue from Any Given Sunday, right, where he talks about football as the game of 1 inch. And, like, it's incredible,
oh,
right?
It's
incredible. Yeah.
I love the eclectic quality of what you just described as the influences. That's
so that's
so
just
cool.
The one song, right? And then so that tells you what form that song is. That song is a pep talk. Like, that's the form of that song. And that form tells you the story as much as the images that are inside it. So, like, if that form is telling the story, then we get to put all kinds of images inside of it. And so the lyrics of that song are, I am a lioness, I am a warrior, I'm the beast who ate its foot out the trap. It's a battle, it's natural to fight. You know, imagine Daphne Rubin Vega. You know, I'm the beast who ate its foot out the trap. You know, she's our muse. We love her. But that's what I think I would answer that question with. And there's other things, you know, the Tamal song that I was talking about is a very much a folk song in the sense that it has two parts. It has a chorus and it has a verse, and they sort of loop onto each other in a way that feels very simple. What's the word I'm trying to think of? Recursive or something, like, in a way that doesn't have a beginning or doesn't have an end. And you know, sometimes the singer gets lost in the form, but it still works. Mm-hmm. And, like, once you figure that out, and that one is a recipe. So that one's actually very specific in terms of what's inside. It's not a character's feelings. It's like cornmeal, masa. You measure the dough by hand. Mm. But the form, I think, tells you that. Mm. And I don't, you know, that's always been my deal as a singer-songwriter, has been, like, form and genre has always been storytelling for me. And I think that has made the transition, you know, easier for me in terms of writing for theater.
That makes sense. Someone asked Benjamin Britten once, what makes a good opera composer? And I don't know what answer they were expecting, but the answer he gave was, an opera composer needs to be able to write a lot of very different kinds of music. And when I first heard that you were working on a show, I thought, that's Aaron right there. Because your songs, I mean, aside from the lyrical content, they are musically extremely varied. So I would assume that you had a whole lot of different colors on the palette that you could bring to the process.
Well, that's part of the proposal about, you know, not to, like, take it to, like, a grand place, but that's part of the proposal about America that our show is trying to make. Mm-hmm. Whether it's everything from our casting to the way we've set up the production to the fact that the music covers a whole lot of different ground within one song, or even if you look at the score as a whole, which is that, we aren't all just one thing, you know, and I actually think no matter who you are, you don't just listen to one thing. So it makes sense to me. And it's actually, like, counterintuitive to me that someone would only write one kind of music or would only have one kind of music on their phone or something like that. Mm-hmm.
That's really true. And the musical is the hybrid sort of, it's the parasitic form of American theater. It takes its influence from it sucks up everything. Mm-hmm. And that's a great description in artistic form of what that means, which I love. Aaron, does this, like, feed a desire? Obviously, you're right in the middle of this. It's very hard to sort of predict.
So the
but is it? But does it like? Does do other musicals start to percolate in your head, or does it feel like a distraction to some degree from what you from the other things
you do?
You
mean like the next thing I want to write?
In other words, yeah. Would you? Yeah. In other words, does this is this like one of those detours? Then you go back to what? To what you were doing before, or is it? Do you see this just as an expanding of your palette that can go all kinds of ways?
If you'd asked me, you know, a year ago, was this the only musical I'd ever write? I'd say, fuck yeah, because it's so hard. And like,
it is hard.
It's really
it?
Hard. Yeah. Yeah, it's harder than anything else I've ever done.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
that's so interesting.
And I have a long career, which you know, but now, you know, then I had an idea for something that I got really excited about. So.
That's great.
What I'm curious about is that there seems to have been a sea change in the past, I would say maybe 5 or 10 years, was more, let's say, pop in a very, very wide sense. Songwriters are coming to musical theater. Like 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I think the pipeline was like the BMI workshop or something like that, like a very specific musical theater pipeline, which I personally really cannot stand the BMI workshop pipeline. It's just horrendous. But there, and also I think there was a kind of weird thing between the pop rock universe and musical theater where they were not gelling. But now, like, that thing seems to be collapsing. You know, there's you, there's obviously Sarah Bareilles.
Yeah, I mean, I run a
so
group.
Many.
I run a group for singer-songwriters who are writing musicals.
What?
Really?
Yeah, I run a group that I started about 5 years ago.
Like a support group where you all cry together?
Group. No, it's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it starts for. It's an email chain that I started. And it's, I'll tell you who's in it right now. It's me and Anais Mitchell, who is a longtime friend of mine and also a singer-songer.
Hadestown
last summer, New York Theater Workshop. Sarah Bareilles, who is in some ways like the flagship example because of how successful Waitress has been.
Right, right.
She's someone I'd like to know if she'll do it again. But anyway, so it's me, Anais, Sarah, Susan Werner, who's, a longtime peer of mine from singer-songwriter world, who's been writing Bull Durham for a long time.
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And Faith Soloway, who is another singer-songwriter peer of mine, who's working on a Transparent musical.
Right.
Amazon series. She and her sister are the creators of
Jill Soloway, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. So, And Roseanne Cash is our newest member. And I ran into her at a show downtown.
Oh, Roseanne Cash. I'm sorry. I didn't. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that for a second.
I ran into her show at a show downtown in December and, you know, said, like, hey, we're, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, she's like, oh, you know, Jazz at Lincoln Center. And she's curating something in San Francisco. She says, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm writing a musical. And she was like, oh, I actually am too. So there's a couple of things that we say to each other immediately following the, like, oh, you're writing a musical, which is like, holy shit, this takes a long time.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing. And the other thing is, well, I don't want to give it away. It's, you know, secret support group. But you know, it's different.
Right.
It's a different world. And
I'm excited that you bring Roseanne Cash up because I just saw her a few days ago. And she premiered 9 songs from that musical, which is an adaptation of Norma Rae.
Yeah.
The movie that earned Sally Field.
Sure.
And I cannot wait. I hope they get it somewhere, produced somewhere, because there's a great, like, the great cathartic song right now from what she performed was something called the Vote Song, which obviously is the scene in the movie when Norma Rae has the, you know, the union.
The sign up on the desk.
I was just like, I cannot wait. This is the time is so ripe for this.
Right.
But the songs were absolutely lovely. And
it doesn't surprise me because let me look at her writing career. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, she's an amazing, like, prose author. And then she has these, like, beautifully varied albums that have just grown more poetic with time. So, I think all of us in this group, like, I think the thing we struggle with is not, can we write these songs or do we have the skills? It's the apparatus around it. It's that it takes this long to get money. A workshop can only get you this far.
Right, because you mentioned you started, when did Kiara email you? Like
2011. 2011.
Okay. So of course you as a singer-songwriter, you can get a song out like this.
Right. I could have made 4 albums. I'm not kidding. If I had my regular time schedule, I could have. Right.
So what's the rehearsal process been like for you? Has it opened up? Does it explode some of the notions you had for what you thought you had, or does it confirm for you that you were there? And have you had to do a lot of tinkering?
When we had the show in La Jolla in 2016, that rehearsal process was more focused on. Again, like a form of the show and trying to, that was the first time it was really up on its feet. We'd had a number of...
The first time you saw the show, where was your, was it like, oh God, like, what was it like?
It was a combination of things. I mean, it's, I would say like for me, this process has been learning to trust the fact that, that I do actually know what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. I may have never made a musical before, but I do actually know what I'm seeing. Because I love theater.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of things. But then I've also made a lot of things. Like, for 20 years, I've been producing records and making shows and writing songs. I'm also the orchestrator on our show.
That's a key element.
Oh, totally.
It's extremely. Yes. And I feel like I am as responsible for as much storytelling in that as I am in, as the writer. And my co-orchestrator is a wonderful guy, Charlie Rosen, who's done a bunch of stuff for Jason Robert Brown. And, so he in some ways comes from a traditional theater world, though he's not traditional at all. He's someone who plays like 25 instruments and loves to learn six languages. And I never know where he is. He'll be like, oh, I'm in Havana, you know? So cool. He's a great match for me in that. But the first time I saw it, I had thoughts of things I wanted to change, you know, and, Kiara did too, and Lear did too. Anyone who saw the La Jolla production will see this public production. We have been told that we, you know, have rarely seen something change so much in between those two productions. So, that's exciting to me.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there's a, part of it must be exciting. The idea that, well, if you release an album, it's done. And here you can just tinker and get...
I've never rewritten songs as much as I have in this process. And again, I think Kiara's, as a writer, she's, I say this in the most positive way. She is relentless about really, like, really wanting to get something and really getting in there. I was coming from a world where I'd write a song, and 2 weeks later I put on a record, and it might change when I played it in concert, but that it was in some ways like fully baked. And I can't even tell you the revisions. I mean, you can guess. Right. I love that process. I mean, I basically feel like if you give me time and you give me money, I can make something good. But I haven't had those things before.
Right.
Right? I've been on this shorter cycle, and the music business has no money left in it. And, you know, so, like, to have two people to have these resources and opportunities with these collaborators, like, we should make something good. You know what I mean? I think it would be more of a letdown if it wasn't, given the time we've had on it.
Yeah. One last question. You mentioned Sarah, who wrote the score for Waitress, and she's actually appeared in the show on Broadway. Is that something you have any interest in doing at some point in the future?
I have thought about it when when we've had, like, casting like debacles or something about, like, I'll just do it myself, you know. But that's not. I don't think, in a show that I wrote, I don't think that's the best use of my time. That's just me, but Sarah's madly talented, and I think it sounds like the most fun to take the Corvette for a ride. And I don't know how Lin-Manuel does it either, you know. He has amazing collaborators to hold him up and be his eyes and ears in a lot of ways. But no, it's not. That's not something that I would do for my own work. But it'd be fun for somebody else's work. I think, why not?
Yeah. You know, I know you're in the middle of rehearsals, so I guess we should turn you loose. But I must tell you, this has been one of the most illuminating interviews I've ever been involved with. I feel like you've opened a door on the process of how musicals get written, especially today.
I think we should have Erin back at regular intervals.
Hearing you guys talk. Like, that's one of the things I've enjoyed about listening to this, and I feel like I didn't get to hear you guys talk, so...
We wanted to hear you.
Yeah. Let's do it again.
We will.
Well, thank you so much for coming to the studio to chat with us.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it more than we can say.
I look forward to you guys seeing the show.
Can't wait.
So do we. Now, let's spend a few minutes talking about the other shows we've seen since our last episode. Elizabeth, let's start with you.
Well, I just saw a production called Yerma, which bears the same name as the Federico Garcia Lorca play from 1934. And that's pretty much it, because the director, Simon Stone, completely rewrote it. There's almost nothing left except the general idea of the show, which is a woman who's craving to have a child. And other than that, it's completely rewrote the whole thing. It's at the Park Avenue Armory, and the set is this plexiglass box with the audience on both sides, and the actors are mic'd in an incredibly powerful way. This is one of the best uses of sound design that I've seen and heard in a long time. It features a completely incredible performance by Billy Piper, who amazing. I think is it's a London production,
right,
that they've brought
Young
in.
Young Vic. It was at the Young Vic.
Yes. And Simon Stone is a young Australian director, works a lot in Europe and Australia, and I believe that's his first show here. I highly encourage, it's running through April 21st, I believe, in New York, and I highly encourage people who are interested in the possibilities of staging to see it, because the technical aspects of it are absolutely incredible. The scene changes, the use of sound, then you can bicker and argue about what the play itself is doing. But on a technical point of view, it's completely expanding, because really, I can really say that nobody in the U.S. is doing this kind of work at this level of craftsmanship, which is completely extraordinary. So just for that, I would say, if you're interested in what theater can do, technically speaking, just go see Yerma at the Armory. So that would be it for me.
I'm going to just mention briefly a production of Translations, Brian Friel's play about Ireland in 1833 at Studio Theater in D.C., directed by Matt Torney. It's a play that doesn't get done as much as I think it should be done, and Friel is so rewarding. His language in a play about language is superb, and it's one of those plays that takes some time to get accustomed to the accents and to Americans playing characters in County Donegal, but once it settles in, it's a beautiful and enlightening ride.
And I'll say a few words about Kenneth Lonergan's Lobby Hero, which was first performed off-Broadway in 2001, but is only just now receiving its Broadway premiere in a revival directed by Trip Cullman. I don't know if it's Lonergan's best play. I think it may be his most provocative play. And this is not a perfect revival. I find it a bit jokey, especially Michael Cera. This is a dead serious play. It's also quite funny, but you don't have to lean on the laughs for them to land. But it features two very remarkable performances, one by the big name star, Chris Evans, Captain America, as a bent cop, but the other by Brian Tyree Henry as a security guard who finds himself caught in a profound and unanswerable moral dilemma. It's one of those beautiful, subdued, strong, centered performances. It isn't flashy in any way, but it completely conveys what the play and the part are trying to say. And the play comes through with great clarity. And if you haven't seen it, or if you don't know Lonergan's work, I think it's a very good place to start. I hate to say it, but it looks like we've run out the clock for this episode. We've all got plenty to do and see before that next curtain goes up. So for now, let's wrap it up. As always, I'm Terry Teachout.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
And I'm Peter Marks. You've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate, and you can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle, and you can write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com, and both times it's spelled out Three on the Isle.
And please make sure you leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on the aisle.